Please be seated. Sitting five, I have not been advised by the other two that they're not participating. I haven't been advised that they're late, so we'll see. 12AP 1827D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus John J. Carter. Mr. Gimbel, you represent Mr. Carter, and you have 25 minutes. Mr. Price, you represent the Office of Lawyer Regulation, you get 30 minutes. And Mr. Gimbel, you have 5 in rebuttal. Right?
My understanding.
Line 2.
Good. We're on the same page. Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Franklin Gimbel, and I am here today representing John Carter. As a predicate to my discussion of the legal issues in this case, I would like to share with you what I view to be a prologue to this case. John Carter was born in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. He went to high school in Hurley, Wisconsin, graduating from that school in 1961. Following his graduation, he signed up for and was accepted in the United States Marine Corps. This was a time when there were various and sundry conflicts between the United States and other entities in the Caribbean and most significantly in Vietnam. John Carter served as a high school graduate in the Marine Corps honorably for 3 years, during which service he did see combat in the Caribbean and in Vietnam. After his graduation or discharge from the Marine Corps, he came to Milwaukee and took a job for a few months, and thereafter his application for a position on the Milwaukee Police Department was granted. He joined the Milwaukee Police Department in 1964. On a fateful day in July of 1967, John Carter was one of 5 police officers in a squad car during a period of time when there were racial disturbances that were very significant. I can tell you from a personal point of view, at that time, I was situated as an assistant United States attorney in Milwaukee, and I was enlisted by then Attorney General Ramsey Clark, Attorney General of the United States, to be a monitor for him directly relative to how the Milwaukee Police Department was dealing with minorities in the central city of Milwaukee. During that period of unrest, there was a declaration of an emergency, curfew was imposed on folks, and the National Guard was called up and tanks were on the street. It's in that environment that John Carter, as one of 5 people in a squad car, was directed to a location on North Avenue in Milwaukee with the admonition that there was gunshots, one officer was down, and another officer was missing. He entered into a building in response to that direction, and he was shot in the face. The consequences of that tragic event in his life led to his loss of vision. But John Carter, after he was instructed by his medical attendants, did not retreat in an area of self-pity to sitting and collecting some kind of disability payments. He rather enlisted himself as a student at Marquette University and for the first time attended university classes. After 3 years in university and 3 years in law school, there was an opportunity at that time for a combination of undergraduate and law school education. He received both a bachelor degree and he received a Juris Doctorate degree. Beginning then in 1974, John Carter began the practice of law, and within a relatively short period of time after he began that practice of law, he was engaged by the city of Milwaukee, Grant Langley, who was then the city attorney, on a contract basis to, A, represent the city in then pending litigation, which included oftentimes cases involving police misconduct litigation that flowed out of the Fire and Police Commission. As the years rolled by, his different positions with the city attorney increased. And among the things that he was invited to do was to take over the prosecution function of the city attorney's office. And under his leadership and under his direction, a great backlog of cases were taken care of. As John Carter moved down the road of his law practice, curiously enough, one of his most significant extracurricular activities that did not generate income for him was to become involved in an evaluation of ethical behavior. And he served for 2 decades on the Milwaukee County Board of Ethics, serving as its chairperson for many of those years. He also served on the disciplinary committee for the Milwaukee operation of the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility, which graduated into the Office of Lawyer Regulation. During that period of time and up until the year 2008, John Carter did not have any disciplinary accusations made against him as a lawyer. But in 2008, he engaged in behavior, the gravamen of which is significant, substantial, and egregious. And it constitutes the basis of the complaint that was brought by the Office of Lawyer Regulation against John Carter in the year 2012. Your Honors have all had access to the record and to the briefs, and you will see and you will note that there came a point in time after I was retained to represent John in connection with that Office of Lawyer Regulation complaint. He stipulated with the Office of Lawyer Regulation that he would permit a referee to make a finding that each and every one of the allegations of ethical misconduct should be viewed as proved. He stepped aside from any opportunity to challenge any one of the numerous complaints relating to his relationship with Nancy Neske, who is a long-term client of his. Nancy Neske was a person who in her later life was sight impaired herself. And if you look at the testimony of the character witnesses, you'll see there was a relationship between John Carter, Grant Langley, the city attorney, Grant Langley himself, a very significant participant in the area of lawyer discipline, serving as chairperson of the local grievance committee in Milwaukee for a number of years and serving with John Carter during that period of time. It was also Grant Langley that sent Nancy Neske to John Carter. And John Carter and an associate of his provided multiple legal services to Nancy Neske. The one that gave rise to these charges was his representation of her in connection with the sale by her of a business, which generated sale proceeds in excess of $100,000, which were deposited in John Carter's trust account.
How long did Mr. Carter retain these trust funds of Ms. Neske before he gave her the total balance of what was left?
It's about 12 months, Your Honor.
About a year. That's the way I figured it.
Yes. During that period of time, there was a dialogue between John Carter and Nancy Neske, and it is admitted that during the course of that dialogue between those two people, John Carter misrepresented the status of the funds of Ms. Neske, and in fact commingled the funds that he was holding. It was something in the neighborhood of about $75,000, the balance of which was returned. And he commingled them into his personal funds, and he misapplied them and used them for personal purposes, business purposes, that he testified about in the hearing that led to the decision that we're here to discuss today.
helpful. You said you made a reference to $75,000.
Yes, Your Honor.
But I think originally it was $112,500.
That is correct.
And then I think approximately April, for some reason is standing out in my memory, that he returned a portion of it, explaining to her that he had invested it. And this is her first repayment. I might be wrong on the
point. You're accurate. I'm not going to dispute you, but that's the sequence of events.
Okay.
That
I just
wanted
to thank you.
Yes. So now John Carter, the person who was essentially literally a police officer for the United States when he did his service with the Marines, literally a police officer for the Milwaukee community when he served as a member of the Milwaukee Police Department, and figuratively as a police officer when he engaged in the role of being an ethics evaluator for county employees and for lawyers, and processed a number of complaints. This case today brings before you no challenge to the referee's findings of fact.
And they're serious. Converting
question, they are serious and egregious.
That's your phrase, and
I am not here to mitigate his behavior. I am here seeking to mitigate the sanction for the reason that, as this court has said on numerous occasions, that the court looks to the findings of fact for what might be viewed as errors in the referee's reasoning to reach the findings of fact. We're not on that page. But this court has also said that each lawyer discipline case stands on its own legs. That might be the exact words that you use, but that's the essence of what this court has said in numerous lawyer discipline cases.
And you're objecting in your brief to, I think it was three cases that the referee relied on as being comparable, or that to be compared to. You don't think they're comparable, and even if they were, you'd say, hey, there are differences here.
Essentially, yes, Chief. Essentially, yes. But when we get right down to it, I am taking you up on your word, you and your prior colleagues, when you say that each lawyer discipline case will be judged on its own elements, including those elements that have to do with the character of the person who is the object of lawyer discipline, and also looking at the point of view that I think was fairly well articulated in one of the Bridget Boyle cases, and I'm going to quote from the case that you wrote about her in December of 2013, when you said, as a group, the purpose of lawyer discipline is to protect the public, the courts, and the legal profession in Wisconsin from incompetent and unfit attorneys. And you cite the case of Henkel. The public, the courts, and the Wisconsin legal profession need protection from Attorney Boyle until she demonstrates to this court, before she resumes practice, that she has made efforts to bring her behavior in line.
Now, in this case, if I understand it, the client did not suffer financial loss because he paid everything back, right?
That is accurate, but to be perfectly candid, not to have any misunderstanding about that, paid everything back with a retention of fees, which were originally disputed and ultimately were mediated, and an agreement was reached between Ms. Neske and Mr. Carter for an offset of the fees for the representation in the matter at hand.
So that was about $38,000, do I recall correctly?
I don't remember the exact ultimate figure, Justice, but it was something in the neighborhood of $30,000, yes.
And any interest on having retained these funds for a year?
There was no interest paid.
Pardon me?
There was no interest received or paid.
Who Did Ms. Neske require a lawyer to represent her to get this money back ultimately?
I can't answer that question. I don't think so, but I can't answer that question. She had a lawyer someplace down the road, and I don't know whether it was prior to the filing of the complaint or afterwards.
When he paid her, he did not pay her more than was in the account. He didn't pay her for a lawyer fee.
I'm sorry.
He did not pay her for any legal fees she may have incurred.
That is correct.
He only paid her what would have been owed on the money he received less the amount he kept for that was agreed upon for attorney fees.
Yes, Chief, okay. That is correct.
So to say that she wasn't financially harmed may be an overstatement, but she got at least back the trust fund.
And I don't think I said she wasn't financially harmed. That was not my intent. She certainly was financially harmed if you figure that she lost the use of her money for this period of time.
Yes,
I concede that.
A lot of other people are financially harmed when there's conversion by never seeing the money again.
I understand that part very well. I've been doing this for 54 years, so
right.
I've seen a lot of that. So this case starts out with the Office of Lawyer Regulation filing its complaint on the 16th of August in the year 2012. The request, the sanction at that time when the original complaint was filed, was to bring about the disbarment of Attorney Carter. With the acquiescence of my colleague, Mr. Price, asked to have an audience with the officials of the Office of Lawyer Regulation to discuss whether or not in advance of any hearings they might modify their position relative to disposition. And we had a conversation, and we were greeted openly, and as a consequence in the outgrowth of that meeting with the appropriate Office of Lawyer Regulation officials, including Mr. Price, was that there was an amendment of the wherefore clause in the Oler complaint seeking a 3-year suspension.
Instead of revocation?
That is correct.
Okay. You know, you started out with a prologue, and whether it's a prologue or an epilogue, I heard you indicating mitigating factors for the sanction.
Correct.
Because we agree, or at least you agree, this was egregious.
Agreed.
Conversion is egregious.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm looking at the brief of OLR, pages 24 and following, in which they give aggravating factors and mitigating factors. And isn't that the issue here, for the court to look at the aggravating and mitigating factors to determine the appropriate sanction?
From a global point of view, absolutely correct.
Okay. And I'm willing to – you just started on a personal level and the personal life, and part of that is in here, but not as much as you gave. So – aggravating factor, page 24, dishonest or selfish motive. He needed this money for his own use, whether he bought luxuries or it was required for food or to cover everyday expenses. He used it for personal expenses.
That is correct.
Okay. So you view that as an aggravating factor?
I kind of figure that's a neutral. It's wrong to take money that someone owns in your trust account and use it.
Okay.
That's wrong. Now, whether or not that's aggravating because these are for personal purposes against giving it to the United Way, okay, I would concede that if he gave it to the United Way, then perhaps that would be less aggravating than using it for personal purposes. But it is what brings me here today. The fact he shouldn't have used that money. He had no right to use it.
Right, and using it for certain personal purposes might be more offensive to people than using it for medical coverage for your child.
If
buying designer dresses.
Well, he didn't use it for designer dresses, nor did he use it for medical expenses. I mean, this was...
He was just to survive.
Right. He was, in essence, you know, Jean Valjean, in a sense that he has been pursued and he is accounting for his misappropriation of trust funds that didn't belong to him. He had no right to use those monies at all for any purpose whatsoever. They belonged to Ms. Neske, and unless she gave him specific permission to use the money for a purpose other than returning it to her, he has grieved against the canons of ethics.
The other, on page 25, multiple offenses. First, there are multiple offenses relating to Neske. And then it says, as well as misconduct relating to trust funds held for the benefit of other clients. Have they all been repaid?
I'm not aware of other trust fund issues that are part of this case.
I'm just looking at
this,
page 25, in total resulting for nine rules. Okay. So it's multiple offenses. So if we eliminate the other offenses, we still have trust fund, no written agreement, failure to communicate with the client. But, of course, the most serious is the conversion.
It all stems from the fountain of the first sin.
Right.
The first sin was not returning the money to Ms. Neske.
Right. And then he had to cover it.
And he had lots of lies.
And then afterwards, there was a cover-up. And there were was a series of misrepresentations that he made, and to which he agreed that he would not contest them because they were true.
Now, the next thing that is an aggravating factor of the OLR is a page 25, submitting false evidence, false statements, or other deceptive practices during the disciplinary process. He was evasive. And about information and documentation until he ultimately acknowledged it. So it wasn't an immediate acknowledgement.
Agreed.
Okay. Substantial
employer, I think he saw the light.
Substantial experience in the practice of law, and this is used that all the, I shouldn't say all, but much of the experience you outline should have told him to do better. He's not a young lawyer not familiar with the basic rules. That's an aggravating factor, according to the OLR.
Yes, Chief. And in fact, I would invite each and every one of you there to open the brief that my office submitted on behalf of John Carter.
Okay.
To page 7.
All right.
And I think if I can read it out loud to you, or you can read it yourself, but I think the gravamen of what John Carter said under oath in response to a question by Mr. Price pretty well encapsulates his acceptance of responsibility, and I think what it also does, and what I think is a significant part of why I'm asking this court to consider modification of the sanctions that are represented here, is that it shows that his awareness transcends that of a typical lawyer because of those things that I've outlined for you here this afternoon that put him in the ring of making recommendations about lawyer misbehavior and what sanctions should flow from that.
That cuts both ways. One, he has the knowledge about ethics and violations and therefore was experienced. And two, it shows his good citizenship in that this was, if I understand your position, a fluke. It happened once because of dire circumstances. Because of his experience, you don't expect it to happen again.
I couldn't have said it any more directly, and I think that if we look at the admonition that this court issued in the Bridget Boyle case, I think that those concerns that the court has when it proclaims what is an appropriate sanction for lawyer misbehavior that will not bounce back on us and come back and the public say, how could you let this man or woman off the hook? And I'm saying John Carter is a very good, substantial risk for you to take unless him off the hook. Hook partially.
The mitigating factors are in 26 and 27, and we've talked about that.
Yes.
The sanction proposed is 3-year suspension, which is just a substantial suspension. Revocation is 5. And you suggest public reprimand for an egregious, serious conversion of funds for a year, followed by the cover-up. Or, if you're going to suspend him, you suggest less than 6 months so he gets back fast because he doesn't have to petition the court. I mean, that's how I read your recommendation.
That's a fair...
How do you justify it?
Well, I justify it this way. John Carter is 71 years old. If this court affirms the recommendation of a 3-year sanction, the effect of that is he's out of business for the rest of his life. Because the process by which a person who suffers a 3 years out timeout on the bench to get back to being a licensed practitioner, assuming he touches all the right bases in his application for readmission, John Carter has now been separated from whatever business clients he has for in excess of 4 years, closer to 5 years. He's in the 77, 78-year range. So he's effectively having his license revoked if you affirm the 3-year suspension. And I'm asking you to let John Carter die as a licensed lawyer. And by reason of the fact that the difference between revocation and a 3-year suspension, including his age, his lack of prior discipline, and the process that we all accept, which is rather cumbersome and difficult for readmission, is very time-consuming. And that combination of things, I suggest, should be a consideration of yours to reduce the sanctions. And you should look at this case, and this is, of course, my expression as his advocate. You should look at a 3-year suspension of John Carter as disbarment, because that's the effect of it. And all of the good stuff that went on in his life that didn't bring him here, didn't bring him before the Office of Lawyer Regulation, is down the drain. And as he said in that testimony that I cited to you in our brief, in his testimony, his epitaph will be, he was a disgraced ex-lawyer when he dies. And I'm asking you to change that so that he can be considered an honorable lawyer who made a huge, egregious mistake, but had an opportunity to remedy for that mistake in a chance that this court might give him to move down the road with some sense of repayment and honor.
I'm more concerned about living as a lawyer than dying as an ex-lawyer.
And there's nothing, Chief, in John Carter's history. And if there was... Harris Taylor would have heard about it, that suggests that he has any other behavior patterns that implicated a threat to the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gimbel. Mr. Price, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation.
Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. I'm Matt Price, retained counsel for the Office of Lawyer Regulation. When a bank robber returns the money once he's caught, the robbery was still committed, and he should be severely punished. And for Mr. Carter's misconduct, he should receive the same consequences. But Mr. Carter did not need to brandish a gun to accomplish his theft. Instead, the weapon he used was his pen to convert $72,000 of client trust funds belonging to Nancy Nesky, and about half as much he converted for his own personal gain. And then it got worse, because for the first 3 months after the $112,500 were received into Mr. Carter's trust account, Mr. Carter artfully dodged Ms. Nesky's multiple requests for information about the status of those funds and her demands to have them distributed to her. Thereafter, for many months, Mr. Carter fabricated and perpetuated a very elaborate scheme about how he ultimately took those funds and invested them elsewhere to receive a higher rate of return. That never happened, and even if it had happened, Ms. Neske never authorized that. And then finally, 8 months after those trust funds were received into the trust account and all the excuses had been used and there was nothing left, he then, despite demands months earlier, submitted his attorney's fee bill to Ms. Neske for the underlying matter. And then he proceeded to hold the balance of the trust funds due until he was able to successfully extract a settlement for the payment of his attorney's fees. Now, as to sanctions, Mr. Carter believes that the appropriate sanction is a public reprimand or something less than a six-month suspension. That would undermine most of the primary goals of attorney discipline. It would not address the seriousness of the misconduct. It would not protect the public, the courts, and the system from repetition of it. And it certainly wouldn't deter others from committing it. To reach that result would require a sidestepping of the three principal tools that this court uses in setting discipline. First, the ABA baseline standards, which, as I noted in my brief, just taking the most serious counts alone suggest a revocation, if not a very significant suspension. And that's each of those two counts alone, and that ignores the other nine counts that we're dealing with as part of this action. Second, a balancing of the aggravating and mitigating factors. We've already gone through those that were cited in my brief, but needless to say, when those aggravating and mitigating factors are balanced, they do not provide any significant relief to Mr. Carter. And lastly, with the Wisconsin precedent, we focused on three cases in our brief, O'Byrne, Krombach, and Goldstein, and when those cases are read together, it clearly frames the matter for an appropriate 3-year suspension of Mr. Carter's license.
Counsel, I'm going to focus on the duration of the suspension in my question. Now, when you are at the edges, when you have revocation, as the case started with, and public reprimand, and your opposing counsel includes public reprimand as one of the requested. Those edges are a bit defined. When you get in the middle of those, it becomes a little more difficult for me. So you went from revocation to 3-year suspension. Why?
As Mr. Gimbel indicated, the case initially charges revocation, and Mr. Gimbel was concerned that OLR did not have all of the mitigating facts available to it when it made its recommendation for a sanction. So at Mr. Gimbel's request, we convened a meeting, and Mr. Saleen ultimately decided that based upon that additional information that was provided to him, that the case more properly fit as a 3-year suspension as opposed to a revocation.
Are the goals of lawyer discipline filled and fulfilled in this case if he would get 2 years rather than 3 years?
I don't know. I think it's difficult, and I think you know your concern is how do you figure that room out? Where is that right perfect fit? I don't think there's any perfect case, and I can't say that this case needs a 3-year versus a 2-year. That difference is very difficult to distinguish. But then again, this is an extremely serious case. Yes, Ms. Neske was fortunate that she was able to receive most, if not all, of her money back, more or less. I think there comes a point where matters like these need to be treated as among the most serious and egregious matters that an attorney can commit, particularly when it involves the relationship with the client and the client's funds. So I don't think there is a perfect number, per se, but we do believe that 2 years or 1 year, or certainly 6 months or less than 6 months, doesn't appropriately advance the goals of attorney discipline. So it appears from both the brief and the argument we heard today that Mr. Carter would prefer that this court would impose its discipline basically out of whole cloth, essentially focusing on the mitigating factors that he believes are in his benefit the most, principally.
What do you, excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Okay.
What do you consider the most significant mitigating factor?
I think it cuts both ways. I think that the acceptance of responsibility certainly is one. I think Mr. Gimbel's correct that he did, Mr. Carter did accept the responsibility once Mr. Gimbel did get involved and help streamline the process. That one, I think, is a clearly mitigating factor. But the one that cuts both ways, I think, is his character and reputation, both in the community and the profession. Because I think Mr. Carter, more than most, was well aware of the consequences of his actions at the time he committed them. He was a police officer. Rule number one is you don't steal. As an attorney who served on many ethics committees and boards, people who serve in that capacity are looked up to as a model of the rules of ethics, that they should be applied to themselves and everybody else. So on one hand, a strong mitigating factor is not a lot of history and good character, but on the other hand, it's that character and reputation that was failed. That was the biggest failure he had in this case, is putting his reputation up and hoping that he wasn't going to get caught. I think that it's important that we not just focus on those two factors, principally acceptance of responsibility and his character and reputation in the community, because this court engages in a balancing of aggravating and mitigating factors. You can't just isolate two particular factors in achieving a result.
Then let me ask the corollary question, and what do you consider the most aggravating of the factors?
Well, I think the most aggravating factor, without a doubt, is the dishonest and selfish motive. Mr. Carter was, among other things, having a failing side business, and he took his money as if it was his own. And then to perpetuate the charade of this investment, which he never made and came up with story after story, and I would direct this court perhaps the most egregious, as in the appendix at page 111, where I quote, where an email is quoted, where he is not just saying, I invested your money and I'll try and get it to you as soon as I can, but he goes into tremendous amount of detail about, I invested this amount of money here and the rate of return is going to be X and Y and then I can get the money in a couple of days. It was so elaborate and so deliberate that I think that without question is the most significant aggravating factor. I think they need to balance the aggravating and mitigating factors, but I think those factors are also viewed in context of the other tools this court uses to impose discipline.
What about Mr. Carter's age and ability and probability of returning to practice after a suspension of anything after 6 months, because 6 months can drift into almost a year, 3 can drift into 4 or more, or less. But
it can, but I don't think we want to lose sight of the seriousness of the misconduct, because this is not just about Mr. Carter. This is about the profession, this is about the public, and this is about the system. So if all that mattered today was what's best for Mr. Carter, he recognizes how serious his misconduct is, and a suspension at that age is significant. But on the other hand, to overweigh that consideration when others in the public and others in the system and the courts and other lawyers are watching to see what's expected of them, anything that would result in a less than 6 month suspension or even a 6 month suspension, I don't think properly captures the seriousness and will have the deterrent effect, which is one of the primary goals of discipline. I think that once you put all these factors together, it's dangerous to disproportionately weigh the mitigating factors. And I think that's something that Chief Justice Abrahamson, you brought up earlier, is it's not just the mitigating factors, because the most significant mitigating factors we have here really do cut both ways and really do constitute an aggravating factor, namely the character and reputation. In short, he knew better.
The brief of your opposing counsel, as I recall, ends with talking about the, I was going to say diminution, but I think devastation of reputation for a person who it is portrayed as had a very substantial reputation, a very positive reputation working in the community and for clients, as was testified to by the several witnesses. Is that a mitigating factor? Let me just say, by way of synthesizing it, that he's will continue to suffer. It'll never go away. It's damaging to his reputation, and that's a big consequence that he endures. Is that a I didn't say that all artfully, but
I understand the question.
A mitigating factor?
I think you'd go down a very perilous road by considering having to evaluate what the long-term reputational costs are going to be to a particular lawyer and sort of pushing that into a mitigating consequence. I think that you find that across the state, certain lawyers enjoy really good reputations, and, you know, as they say, you know, the taller they are, the harder they fall. But I think if we start sort of subjectively evaluating, oh, long term, how is he going to be viewed by his friends and his peers as a way to lessen the impact of severe discipline, I think there's a lot of room for inequality and inability to even remotely objectively apply that standard. I think that there's a lot of factors that go into it, and I think that the prior disciplinary history itself is a specific mitigating factor. Mr. Carter doesn't have any prior disciplinary history. So I think it's appropriately cabined at that point. I think once we start looking into predicting reputational effects, I think that's a very untenable road.
Mr. Price, have all of the funds been paid back?
More or less, we believe they have. There was an issue where in the first 3 months, I believe it was a month after specifically when the funds came into Mr. Carter's trust account, he did take a distribution for himself of $5,000 for his attorney fees and never let Ms. Neske know. And from all information we have, it was never disclosed when they ultimately reached a resolution on the attorney's fees. So, but for that money, which we're not certain about, Ms. Neske has passed, so we're not entirely sure about that. But for that money and any outstanding interest that you could argue, no amount was definitive enough for OLR to seek restitution. That having been said, I think the court can take judicial notice that Ms. Neske's estate filed a civil action earlier this year in Milwaukee County Circuit Court against Mr. Carter, and it's my understanding that that matter is still pending.
Pardon me? A civil action for what? Conversion?
I think it has to do with the actions relating to Neske in terms of converting the funds and maybe not arguably making her whole. I have not seen the complaint. I don't know any more details than that.
Has he ever been charged criminally, Mr. Carter?
He has not.
You know, Mr. Price, one part of this case that caught my attention, and part of it is reading between the lines, it seemed to me that there had been some kind of long-standing relationship, whether lawyer-client or perhaps, as those things often do, it had gone into friendship between the late Ms. Neske and Mr. Carter. If this were a criminal sentencing, the law would require the circuit court judge to inquire as to whether victims' rights legislation had been complied with, and as part of that, whether the victim had any anything that they wanted the court to know or take into consideration that was relevant to the determination of sentence. Not to say, of course, as all the lawyers in the room know, that the circuit court would be bound by that. But I am curious, given that longstanding, and I think one of the things that struck me was the great patience that Ms. Neske showed during this process. And that's a patience, it seems to me, that would have come from some kind of affection, respect, and or trust, or combination of all three. Did you consult with her? Did your office consult with her before coming up with this? Did you have the opportunity to talk with her before coming to this proposed resolution that you extended to Mr. Gimbel's client?
Ms. Neske had passed even before the initial complaint had been filed, and I believe she passed in March of 12, and the complaint was not filed until August of 2012.
The estate filed the complaint?
I'm talking about the OLR complaint.
Right.
So the estate complaint was just filed in 2014.
Well, who filed this complaint?
The complaint, my understanding, was actually filed by one of the attorneys who represented Ms. Neske with Mr. Carter years before the underlying transaction here.
Well, you said before the complaint was filed. What about during the investigation?
I don't know because I wasn't privy to the conversations during the investigation. Ms. Neske did actively participate with OLR in providing information and documentation. I don't know that she was ever informed as to what the anticipated sanction request
was. Sure, and under the circumstances, that makes sense. Thank you. You've answered my questions.
Thank you. If there are no further questions?
Are there any other questions?
I will conclude. Thank you very much.
I just have 2 points. One, having practiced law myself for 54 years, which is a plus and a minus, but I think it's a plus. I've been a federal prosecutor. I've been a criminal defense lawyer. I've been involved in many lawyer discipline cases. A lot of the cases that I've handled, for whatever reason, have had significant notoriety, not because of me, but because of the folks that I represented and what they brought to the table. This case will generate tomorrow, a substantial newspaper article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And I know that because Mr. Kerry Spivak is sitting in this room now. He has contacted me. He's contacted the Office of Lawyer Regulation. He's attempted to talk to Mr. Carter. And I know there will be a story tomorrow, which, irrespective of what the court does in respect to what I'm asking you to do, will put Mr. Carter's misbehavior, his egregious misbehavior, out for public view tomorrow in the largest newspaper in the state of Wisconsin. And I take some degree of umbrage when Mr. Price, who I respect as a straightforward lawyer, compares John Carter to a bank robber. A bank robber, and I think he also said he thought he'd get away with it. John Carter could never have had a reasonable expectation that he was going to get away with stealing Nancy Neske's money. Everything that occurred between them, and in particular, I think the observations of Justice Gableman are on point, suggest that this was not a relationship that started with Nancy Neske calling John Carter and said, "I want you to handle the closing of my business." This was a long-standing relationship. There was great patience involved in this thing. In my view, as Mr. Carter's lawyer today after the fact, that was a detriment to him. He would have been better off if Nancy Neske would have said, "If I don't have my money by 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon, I'm going to the Office of Lawyer Regulation." And then we wouldn't have had all this other stuff that occurred that have been now denominated as aggravating circumstances. So you're going to have, from the point of view of deterrence, you're going to have a story that every lawyer in Wisconsin will be aware of tomorrow. That John Carter, the cop who got blinded by being shot in the face, during a civil disobedience in Milwaukee that was racially oriented, has now been brought before the Supreme Court with a recommendation that his license be suspended for 3 years. That's the article's going to say. And also, the suggestion
what's
that...
What's untrue about that?
Nothing. Nothing. But deterrence only works if somebody knows about what happened to somebody. When I stand up in front of a judge and I've got somebody who's embezzled from a business and the newspaper doesn't care about it, they don't write about it, you've deterred the person if you put them in jail, but you haven't deterred other embezzlers because you gave them a 10-year sentence rather than a sentence of probation. That's at least been my experience over the years as a prosecutor and defense lawyer. And those kinds of considerations are relevant to sanctions.
There's just a ton of literature as to what constitutes deterrence, and the social scientists don't agree.
And I've had people whose judgment I respect greatly who don't agree with me. That doesn't mean they're wrong and I'm right. But I remember a conversation I had with a fellow who was a good friend of mine when I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office. His name was Bill Zastrow, and he was the chief probation officer in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. And his view was that the concept of general deterrence is just a fiction. And the way that you prove that is you go to all the states that execute people who commit murders. And does that quell the murder rate? Not at all. By and large, there are more murders in those states where they execute you for doing it than in states like Wisconsin that, in my view, have a more civilized approach to dealing with people who take lives.
Well, now you're comparing lawyers to murderers, and what you've got here is you deal with lawyers who do read the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who do read the compendium, and who might be frightened off or might not be frightened off from conversion. Now, I don't know whether someone would be deterred when they greatly need the money, have no place else to go, and then they dip their hands in the kitty, right?
Agreed. I agree with that, but I also refute the notion that this is equivalent to a bank robbery, and I refute the notion that when this case is given significant publicity tomorrow, that there won't be a lawyer in Wisconsin that's unaware of it, irrespective of whether they take the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel at home or otherwise, because the article that Mr. Spivak writes will probably be picked up by the Madison papers, probably picked up by newspapers around the state, because John Carter is a hero in the eyes of a lot of folks for, like those people that we are going to remember and honor tomorrow, because tomorrow is the anniversary of 9/11, and a lot of safety servants lost their lives because they put their lives on the line in on behalf of their mission of saving the lives of the people that they're paid to protect. That's what John Carter did, and the manifestation of that heroism, and I have no reluctance in calling it that, the manifestation of the heroism is that instead of sitting back and saying, feel sorry for me and support me, he went to college, he went to law school, he spent 40 years as a lawyer, trouble-free, but for this.
You have very ably and several times gone over that, and I appreciate it, but one question that occurred to me as I was reading through the briefs and especially some of the excerpts of the emails that went back and forth between Ms. Neske and your client, and you alluded to it after I asked Mr. Price about I don't know if it was a deep friendship, but certainly there was a friendly relationship between the two of some kind. And the thought occurred to me, and I wonder if the record discloses, since she wound up showing such forbearance, which perhaps in your 54 years of practice you might not have experienced quite as often, and most lawyers probably wouldn't, from clients waiting for their $112,500. Why did he, was he ever asked why he didn't just approach Ms. Neske for a loan?
There's nothing in the record to that end.
Okay. Fair enough.
And I don't want to guess.
Got it. Thank you.
Or go to a bank.
Correct.
A line of credit.
Correct. And I think that was, he had a business that he put his son into in Arizona, and it was financed. And so I think he had exhausted his opportunities to go to the banks, and there were people at the door saying, pay up or we close you up, and I think that's where some of this money wound up, at least according to the record in this case. So he stepped up for his kid after he got his kid in a financial jackpot, you know. But in any event, thank you so much for your attention. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Kimball, and thank you, Mr. Price. And these lawyer discipline cases are always extraordinarily difficult, and the court recognizes that, and extraordinarily difficult for the lawyers that represent them or represent the OLR. That closes our hearing on 2012 AP 1827D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus John J. Carter. Court is in recess. It will meet in closed conference at about 3 o'clock and has additional oral arguments for several days left in September. We are in recess.